Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping. FBI's national security letters. State secrets privilege. TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list. Persecution of government whistleblowers. Perpetual wars. Rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today, Sibel and I are both very pleased to welcome back to our program Colleen Rowley. And it's Colleen with one L. She is a hero to us, and it goes back to the period before 9/11, when she was the chief legal advisor in the FBI office in Minneapolis and advised headquarters in Washington about Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker who was later tried and convicted. Colleen Rowley retired from the FBI after 24 years back in 2004. She ran for Congress, and she has remained very active on issues that she cares about. And I want to just personally thank Colleen, because when I came back from a vacation in early December, she was the first person who alerted me to the real serious problems in the language in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that the president signed on December 31st, and that seriously impairs the constitutional rights of every American. Colleen, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let me begin, because this is part of our series about the emerging police state in the United States. And as someone with a very credible and significant law enforcement background, without any prompting from us or any preconceived notions, what are your thoughts about the state of criminal justice in this country today and the extent to which the apparatus has been transformed into what we would call a police state?
Criminal justice is even misleading, because it implies that there is the criminal procedure that is rooted in the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment, where you have to get a warrant to search, mm-hmm. the Fifth Amendment, right against self-incrimination and right to due process, and the Sixth Amendment, right to counsel, and the Eighth Amendment, right against cruel and inhumane punishment. All of those rights in the Bill of Rights that are actually a part and parcel of the criminal justice system no longer exist if you are accused of terrorism. And that's the problem here, is because it doesn't take any level of evidence. It doesn't take any level of evidence, of course, for the FBI or one of these other investigative agencies now to infiltrate, to spy on, to gather all kinds of data about groups and individuals. It takes nothing of that sort to actually begin spying or gathering info, as it used to under the old Attorney General guidelines. But besides that, essentially, the president now is empowered under the NDAA, and this was a de facto practice that it was already going on, but now it's enshrined in law that was passed by a high majority in both the House and the Senate. And it says that if the executive points the finger at you and says, and without any evidence, without any level of evidence. Now, it would be nice to get Obama on here and see what he, maybe there is some secret process that they won't disclose whereby he consults with somebody to get this list or whatever. Possibly that's true. But right now, the public is unaware of what possible process, what are the procedures whereby the executive branch can simply point and say, we're accusing you of terrorism, and at this point you'll be scooped away by the military, held indefinitely, just as the people at Guantanamo. And it turns out we're repeating a mistake, because at Guantanamo, many of those people that were scooped up and bounties were paid for, there was no level of evidence. And now we're enshrining that as a continuing practice.
And Colleen, if I may just put a number on it, there were 774 total individuals held at Guantanamo in the period starting 10 years ago here in mid-January. And fully 600 of those have been cleared for release without any charge. And of the 170 so who remain, fully half of those have been cleared and are only held there because we won't send them back to Yemen or other countries for political reasons. And so that's the reality of Guantanamo, that three dozen or fewer individuals are actually the so-called high-value detainees who are significant terrorism suspects. 36 out of 774.
Right. And they were not the ones that were that peopled Guantanamo initially.
That's right.
For the most part, they were held in black sites and whatever. And right, there's nothing to distinguish the individuals that where some evidence does exist from the people like Boumediene, who went to the Supreme Court and was mm-hmm. held for 7 years. He was, I think, an Algerian human rights worker, worked for the Red Crescent. And just a bounty was paid, and he was scooped up, and he couldn't get out for 7 years.
And he wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times recently, deploring that he was rounded up with four other people in Bosnia in the months after 9/11. And at least one of those individuals is still held at Guantanamo.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really... And not only are these things shocking and sad to me, but the lack of interest, the lack of compassion on the part of Americans, and the way the Obama administration can calculate that signing the National Defense Authorization Act with its significant rollback in our constitutional rights is not a big deal to the average person, and apparently, based on their polling, not a big deal to the people they expect to vote for Obama's reelection this coming November.
Yep, that's, you know, the thing that's worse in some respects, and actually more surprising that more American citizens now are not upset, is that every bad thing that's happened, everything that's well known now about Guantanamo, the fact that there was no evidence for hundreds of these detainees, the fact that they were tortured, all of those things are well known about Guantanamo. Well, we just passed a law that extends Guantanamo to American citizens. And you would think that that would get a little bit of a rise out of American citizens. And when Obama signed it on New Year's Eve, you would think that some of his base that are so busy now trying to get him reelected, you would think some of them would at least use their power, you know, to say, this is wrong, you know, we got to rescind it. I, of course, am on all kinds of different lists and everything, and I don't see that. I will say one thing, though. I think that another big factor is simply that American citizenry is still very much asleep. I still don't think the majority of Americans, if you even ask, what do you think about the NDAA? I don't think you probably get 70% who even have any idea what it is or what happened.
Well, Colleen, that is an excellent point. I just gave an interview this morning, and this is exactly what I was talking about during the interview. And the fact that, you know, we have been shifting the blame, you know, Congress, the executive branch, the federal courts, the fact that we don't have any separations any longer between the three branches, and all that, you know, are correct. And then, of course, the mainstream media, et cetera. But we haven't spent much time, really, putting some of the deserved blame on the citizenry and on the Americans, we the people. And that is both in terms of, you know, the lack of activism and this whole desensitized approach, attitude towards the whole thing. And then it also comes down to applicability. Somehow the majority see themselves as immune. It doesn't apply to us. It applies to some terrorist. It applies to some Arab guy. It applies to some Taliban guy. It's not about us. Now, with that,
term in the NDAA is significant support. And, you know, most people would think that's similar to the words in the Patriot Act, material support for terrorism. And that has been determined to include advocacy. The Supreme Court in the Humanitarian Law Project last year, I guess it was the summer of 2010, decided that that included speech, advocacy, was encompassed under material support. So if you're going by what we know in the Supreme Court decision, that is extremely broad. That actually, you know, could be giving a speech, giving a talk. It could be writing. Obviously, there have been cases where people have been prosecuted for material support, sending used clothing. Here's the other thing. It even includes, in some cases, sending used clothing or a few dollars to charities that were later found. They weren't even on the terrorist list at the time that the donation was made, but then the group or whatever was added afterwards to the list that our government gets to unilaterally decide who's a foreign terrorist organization. So that's really bad because you could be donating to some group abroad and not have any idea, and there's no intent. This is all criminal laws usually have a real solid intent, because if you don't intend to commit the crime, it doesn't make sense to have it be a crime and punish. But the material support, you don't have to intend to be supporting a terrorist. And again, if you give money or something to a charity and 10 years later it's added to the foreign terrorist organization list, it's that broad right now. And I think Americans do need to do their homework better and realize that the war on terror, quote unquote, that they were sold on, believing that it was on others, that it was on Iraqis and Afghans and Somalians and whatever. They were sold that. But now that war on terrorism has come back, and actually they are under the microscope just as much.
Well, Colleen, even before this NDAA, for example, in my case with the state secrets privilege, the government kept arguing, and not that the courts really demanded much justification or arguing, but the government kept arguing this mosaic theory and saying, yes, she has to be gagged, that the state secrets privilege must be provoked because of the mosaic theory, because even the tiny, tiny little bit of this thing that may seem not even classified is talked about by her or written about, that would then directly or indirectly aid the terrorists who are after us. And this was before this NDAA. So meaning today, with the NDAA, they can just say, you wrote in this blog, and there is really nothing that was previously classified or mentioned as classified. However, we determined this based on the mosaic theory as indirectly aiding the terrorists. And
right.
Therefore, and there is no place that I can go. You know, it's always boiled down to this with my attorneys. I mean, right now, there is a rule for the FBI for pre-publication review. They have to abide by those rules, but nobody can make them do it. They have been holding up my book for a year. They are saying, we are not going to even black it out. You are not allowed to write a book. And and people are saying, there is really no place you can go to the federal court. But you know what they're going to do, as they have been doing consistently for 10 years. So one of the things that I see, even with the alternative media, they usually put all these issues within the context of the foreigners and the terrorists or the terrorist suspects. They don't really, really educate the public about the fact that these are all applicable to regular, ordinary, tax-paying citizens, whether he or she is a blogger or someone who is donating clothes to charity, or maybe through the Facebook, maybe I have 7-8 people who are suspected terrorists. They can go and turn around and use that, and we have no place to go. There actually is no remedy.
Yeah, the judicial branch, as you mentioned, should be, obviously, this is their fault. They need to be looking behind the the assertion of state secrets privilege and find out if it truly does need to be secret. And they don't do that. In fact, I've read now that they're not even reading. They're not even reading the underlying affidavits or requesting further information. They're just taking the government's word for it. If they say it's state secrets, they say fine. Now, that's the opposite. And, of course, WikiLeaks, prosecution of Bradley Manning and possibly the later a prosecution of WikiLeaks, and as well as other reporters who are trying to write about what's going on. That's based on those same theories as what you talked about, the mosaic theory. They can't really show harm from disclosure of information, so they say that, well, any little information could conceivably cause damage. That's, of course, it's wonderful for their side. If you're the attorney for the government, your job is real easy. it's just the opposite, though. This is where the public understanding of secrecy is way off base right now with this fear-induced war on terrorism. It's just the opposite. If we had not had the level of secrecy, even the level of secrecy before 9/11, we could conceivably have prevented 9/11. Even the disclosure that Moussaoui was arrested in August, by all accounts, that would have prevented 9/11, because the hijackers would have probably stopped their plans right then if they'd known that one of their group had been arrested. So here the government thinks it's so great keeping this secret, and in fact it's just the opposite. They're endangering the American public even to a greater extent with all this excess secrecy. And this is not me saying this. This is many, many security experts. It's just that this really never gets out to the public. The public believes the government is keeping them safe by keeping secrets from them, and it's not true.
And Colleen, it's not a secret that the Inspector General of the Justice Department has repeatedly reviewed the use of national security letters that are authorized under the Patriot Act, which was just renewed for another 4 years without any modifications, and that there's been widespread abuse of the national security letters, which are essentially self-executed warrants that an FBI agent can use on a suspect of any description. And the best known is when they go to a library and demand to see what books or movies I've taken out. The librarian is not allowed to notify me that my files have been reviewed. And the secrecy that surrounds all this is, to me, the definition of a police state, because it's not transparent. It's not a just process that is based on the elements of the Constitution, and in this case, the Fourth Amendment, where probable cause and a court order are required for this kind of intrusive search and seizure. And we now have a case before the Supreme Court where Justice Roberts himself asked the attorney from the Justice Department arguing the case. This is about the FBI's ability to place GPS tracking devices on an individual's car, again, without any court order or any other documentation except these self-executed national security letters. So with the FBI in charge of monitoring itself, and despite these very serious reports from the Inspector General, these programs continue. And I'd like to get you to comment on that, but I want to add one more element, and that is this past summer, despite the law that was passed following the 35-year reign of abuse of J. Edgar Hoover as director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the term was set at 10 years, and it was intended to terminate in the middle of a president's term so that the FBI director would be the least politicized appointment that a president might make. Well, last summer, Robert Mueller's term was extended for 2 years so that the next president will choose a replacement, or I guess extend Mueller's term further early in the next presidential term. What is your comment on both the extension, which violates the spirit of the Watergate reforms, and the reasons why Mueller was held over?
Well, all of the reforms post Church Committee reforms that were basically a response to the excessive and abusive spying that went on during the 60s and the 70s, the guilt by association, the setting up Martin Luther King, blackmailing Martin Luther King, all of these terrible things that went on in the 60s and the 70s, of course, were remedied by these restrictions put on after the Church Committee, the Attorney General guidelines. I think the 10-year term, the 10-year term came on after Hoover died in 1972, I believe. And it was a response to, you know, his 47 years, unbelievable.
I understated that. 47 years.
And, you know, in all fairness to J. Edgar Hoover, I still haven't seen the movie yet, but in all fairness to him, when he started off as a young man, he certainly was an aggressive crime fighter, and he was a publicity hound. And there were some other, obviously, faults that he had even as a young man. But he had some good ideas. He started the fingerprint repository. He tried to professionalize the FBI. Very few people understand, but the FBI is why we have the Miranda rights. It was J. Edgar Hoover's FBI that decided to come up with this formula long before the Supreme Court mandated the Miranda rights. So in any event, he had done some decent things as a young person, some bad things as well, but as he goes on, as he gets into 20, 30, 40, 47 years, and what the FBI at the time, I don't think this exists any longer. I think that there are other agencies, number one, that are much more powerful than the FBI right now in the national security surveillance complex or top secret America, whatever you want to call it. The FBI is actually now a small player. It's not at all what it was under J. Edgar Hoover. But under J. Edgar Hoover, because of the spying that went on, he had so much information on officials in Washington, even presidents, presidents' wives, that he could kind of control policy and all kinds of things. Certainly the McCarthy period, Hoover was behind that. So you see a person, an unelected person for 47 years with more power than the president.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that was true. So that is no longer the case. Of course, there's supposed to be a 10-year term, which is a remedy to the 47. But additionally, the FBI went way down in power. It does not have that power. It shares, of course, the spying alone, the CIA and all these. CIA is not even supposed to be spying on domestic citizens. NSA is not supposed to be spying domestically. But both of those organizations now are deeply involved domestically. There's been this big blending of intelligence gathering, and it's much more than the FBI. And then state and local as well, fusion centers. I mean, it's all over. So we have probably as much to fear as citizens from just a rogue person in any of these agencies that decides to use information for their own, and this happens in law enforcement all the time. There's, you know, rogue officers who decide to misuse their position. Going back to the 10 years, there's another point I wanted to make, which is that when you substitute, Obama has been terrible at appointing. He has been slow in appointing. He's left many positions unfilled. And probably the reason for this is it's politically difficult for him to pick somebody. He doesn't like these scandals that go on when he names someone. Oh, and then they find out the person's had sex affairs. I mean, all the different things that can go on when you politically appoint somebody.
And he didn't even use the presidential prerogative to replace Bush's U.S. attorneys, the 94 political appointees who run prosecutions across the country.
Right. He didn't change Department of Defense. Gates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ones that he didn't have to change, he didn't. The ones that were open, this open appointments, a lot of them are still open. 3 years later, of course, my pet peeve is the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. That is supposed to have five positions, and the last time I checked, Obama had named two, and the Senate had never filled them. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Now that's like 5 or 6 years that's never. It's never even been filled.
Yeah.
So I think the reason he didn't change Mueller is he figured it would just be problematic to name somebody else. From the citizen standpoint, we could have actually gotten a new person who could be worse. when Bush took it, when Ashcroft resigned, they put in Gonzalez, and when Gonzalez left not voluntarily, mm-hmm. but left, then they put in Mukasey. And each one of these three was worse than the earlier one. As bad as Ashcroft was, Gonzalez was worse.
Now, Colleen, I take your point about that, and I do understand, but I emphasize the remark you made just before that the president is really shy about taking on controversial appointments that require Senate confirmation. There are many ways to get around that, but retaining Mueller was simply an easy fix. Now, I understand that aspect of it as well, but I have to ask, has Mueller figured out or followed in the pattern of J. Edgar Hoover? Because he is a highly political figure. He was in there in the Bush White House pushing for the expansion of presidential and then, in turn, the authority that the Justice Department had. And in Sabell's case, he was extremely aggressive and highly political. So I have to at least ask the question, do you have any suspicion that Mueller has used his power and the knowledge he has in those files to preserve his job and to extend his term?
I don't know if he's used any information, you know, in that. I think all the people inside the Beltway, to some extent, they talk about knowing the skeletons. And so I think it's just a power means, in, you know, knowing things about people allows you to keep their silence or to actually improve your own situation. I think that's just common in power positions. But I think Mueller, he certainly betrayed the civil liberties people from his first year when he gave the speeches and got applauded by the ACLU, and he did seem to be genuine back in that first year. And then as the pendulum slowly shifts to this kind of police state, and he, in a couple of minor ways, he stands up, tries to stand up a little bit. Recently, with the NDAA, he testified. In fact, some of those senators who were against it used Mueller's testimony to say that this is not a good idea. You know, Mueller must have said, I think it was light what he said, but he did say a couple of things that, you know, he was not in favor of the NDAA.
But Colleen, weren't the remarks attributed to Mueller and the other cabinet officials who opposed it related to the requirement that terrorist suspects be handled by the military? It was not about the rights of American citizens. It was about the rights of foreign-born individuals detained for terrorism and the desire of members of Congress in both parties that these be handled by the military and ultimately end up at Guantanamo. That was the struggle that Mueller and the others were fighting back on. It was not the rights of Americans related to unlimited detention without trial.
Yeah, I think there was a self-interest there because the FBI wants to keep the criminal justice system. That's where, you know, that's the bread and butter of the FBI. The intelligence side is where the CIA and other agencies and the military operate. So much more so than the FBI. The FBI is only counterintelligence. So from a very self-interested standpoint, the terrorism is the big deal. It's where all the money is. And so if the FBI is cut out of all of the efforts on terrorism quickly, you can see. Plus, it's just pragmatic. I think he had a couple of examples in a pragmatic way where, of course, the FBI might be investigating somebody, and all of a sudden they'd have to call up the military and say, take over, we're out of here. Well, that's, of course, very, from an agency standpoint, that is giving up power. And I think you're right. I absolutely, you know, some of his testimony was because it's the self-interest of the FBI to keep that jurisdiction over the terrorism otherwise. But I agree with it. I totally disagree with making terrorist crimes into these wars. I mean, by elevating a terrorist as different than a criminal and making them into a state, that's the whole problem, is they made this into, you know, individuals should be treated as criminals and not treated as state actors or whatever.
Well, I fully agree with you there. It's just that the media has mischaracterized the opposition orchestrated by the White House to the NDAA. It was never about the detention potential for an American citizen. And Carl Levin, the chair of the Armed Services Committee, was explicit about that, that the White House instructed him to remove a clause that would have clarified the law and prevented it from applying to an American citizen in the United States.
Well, that's right. Obama wanted this to apply to citizens. I will say that right now, in attempting to get this rescinded or to get attention to the problem of the NDAA, the fact that it does include American citizens is probably the strongest thing we have going. Because if you go back to what Sabell said, as long as people think that it's only happening to Afghans or to other foreign terrorists, they don't care. So the fact that it does encompass American citizens, I think, is key to our continuing efforts. Montana, you may have heard this or read about it. Montana, because they are a state that their state law allows recall of federal senators and federal congresspersons, has launched recalls of their two senators and a congressperson who have voted for this NDAA. And there's actually sample language out online that states that don't even have, there's about eight or nine states that have the authority to recall federal elected congressmen and senators. But for the others, Minnesota's not one of them. So, but even in the state like Minnesota, we could actually go to our state legislature with this model legislation and try to get them to pass themselves the authority to recall federal officials. And there's a real strong argument that when you vote something that's unconstitutional like this, that you then are subjecting yourself to recall. And it does take the population now. It takes people to get petitions signed. It takes people to go to their legislature. It would take state legislatures and the states that allow it to start these recalls. But this would get the attention. This would actually serve now to educate more people. And as long as it includes American citizens, and there's only 14 senators that are worried enough about the fact that it includes American citizens with no due process, can be detained, scooped up, put in a military place forever with no due process at all. There's only 14, I think, senators who have signed on to this Feinstein bill that would just remedy that one little part.
Mm-hmm. And I want to note that as we're speaking here in mid-January, Chris Hedges, who is a man I have great admiration for, a longtime New York Times correspondent in the Middle East, he has been a vocal supporter of the Occupy movement, and he is the co-founder of TruthDig.com. Hedges has retained an attorney named Carl Mayer. And Mayer was leading a class action suit that I was involved with that got dismissed related to the illegal wiretapping domestically of American phone conversations. Mayer has filed suit together with attorney Bruce Offron in the Southern District Court in New York City, basically challenging the authorization for use of military force that is embedded in this new National Defense Authorization Act. And it is under those umbrellas that they are trying to codify the practices that, Colleen, you mentioned, have been conducted since 9/11, but really were well outside the law. And they're trying to regularize this illegal behavior in the same manner they did the illegal wiretapping through the so-called FISA Reform Act of 2008. So no telling how this suit will proceed, but I do commend Chris Hedges for bringing it, and I'd like to see others do the same. You know, there's an investigation underway in England right now about the rendition of a Libyan by the British. They picked him up in Thailand, and they sent him to Libya where Gaddafi tortured him. And this man is, I'm looking for his name in my mind, it ends in U.S., he has filed suit in England to expose the kidnapping that he and his wife were subjected to, the torture that he received. And when I reported on this last week, my comment was, we could use a little bit of that over here.
Yeah, but we can't. In the United States, our courts, there's one exception for American citizens. There were contractors that were tortured apparently in Iraq, and they have allowed that suit, a judge has allowed that suit to go forward without the state secrets privilege. But by and large, in the United States, if you sue, could be for, you know, a horrendous crime like torture, the court will dismiss it as under the state secrets privilege. The other court out there that's doing is trying to hold Americans accountable is the Spanish court. And this judge, oh, I'll forget his name now, there was one judge, Garzon, and he was removed, but now there's a new judge in charge. He had asked the United States, because these are, I believe, Guantanamo detainees who were tortured, or at least alleged that they were tortured, and he asked the United States, you know, what are you doing? You know, because if the country where this occurs is doing something, then a foreign country is not supposed to get involved. That's under international law. And the United States apparently was so arrogant, they never even answered the Spanish judge. So now the Spanish judge is going forward with the lawsuit of these detainees who allege they were tortured. So maybe there's something to come of that.
And let me correct myself. The Libyan who has sued Britain is Abdel Hakim Belhaj, B-E-L-H-A-D-J. And so I think that is a case that will be very interesting going forward. Colleen, I'd also just like to ask you briefly to comment on the extraordinary execution of an American citizen. We used a drone strike in Yemen to take the life of Anwar al-Awlaki. And he has been accused of supporting terrorists who tried to harm the United States, and of creating videos using his speech to advocate against the United States. And while I think that those are serious charges and deserve to be investigated, and if there is sufficient evidence that an individual like that should be brought to justice in the true meaning of the word, or that phrase, the Obama administration, using a secret panel in the White House, we don't even know who the individuals are, who basically made the decision to execute this American citizen. And I find this deeply troubling. It followed on the killing of Osama bin Laden, which also was done without any due process. And we seem to be really moving away from any basis in process and law for these actions, which are unconstitutional and politely termed extrajudicial.
And all of what we're doing also has another really deleterious effect, and that is on the respect worldwide for the United States as a country that, you know, is supposedly honors the rule of law, human rights, and civil liberties. When this, you know, you're right. Perhaps there was some evidence. Perhaps there was some evidence on, certainly on Osama bin Laden. I'm sure they could have mustered some evidence. And on al-Awlaki, there probably was some evidence. It probably went to more to the material support part, advocacy, as opposed to his actual actions in doing something. But I have no way of knowing that. In any event, you know, if you have a country that is unwilling to even put their cards in court and say, this is what we know. Here's a witness, and they're going to testify to this. This is really shocking, because it's saying our country no longer is going to rely or have any trust or confidence in the rule of law or in our court system. You know, we've got 200-plus years of courts, and certainly courts are not the end-all be-all. They make mistakes. The juries certainly are. There's all kinds of problems with juries, and there's certainly a lack of justice in specific cases, but it's the best system that really anyone's been able to come up with. You can't have a secret panel or an individual say, you know, we're going to take this person out, and we're not going to tell the world why we did it. The United States is pretty apathetic about these things. They're not doing much, but the rest of the world is not apathetic, and they see this for what it is. Today, John Huntsman got out of the race, decided, you know, his poll or his standing isn't high enough, so he got out, and he gave this speech. I just happened to be listening to his speech, and he said, "I, the rest of the world looks at the United States as the beacon of democracy. We honor human rights here." And he went on and on, all this flowery talk. And I thought, what is he smoking? I mean, he can talk about here in the United States, that's the case, but that is not the case in the rest of the world. And targeted assassinations are just the probably the epitome of us saying, we give up. We're not going to use our courts of law. We're not going to rely on our Constitution, the open court system and evidence and everything. We're just going to start, you know, dropping bombs and taking people out. That is an unbelievable.
Colleen, back to the police state, the notion of police state. One major issue that I'm dealing with every single day is this notion that there is this this circumstance and this place in life that once we enter is called police state, and everybody would unanimously agree that yes, now we are officially a police state. And most people, even with the academics and the civil liberty movement people, they like to say we are moving towards the police state, as if there is this finish line, the finishing line that we're going to get. And my argument, our argument has been, well, look at everything from NSA's illegal eavesdropping to just with the NDAA and the FBI national security letter, all the stuff you put together and say, well, aren't we already a police state? And why is it that people say, oh, no, that's so radical? That is so very radical. Yes, things are really bad, but we are far from being a police state. And not only the academics and the experts. I mean, I got an email from one individual who, and I'm reading it, says, you spoiled, ungrateful bitch. Where you came from, in your country, right now you be in jail sodomized every single day. How dare you call this a police state? Basically, people saying, you know what? Aren't you able to write all the stuff in your news site? Aren't you able to interview Colleen Rowley, and Colleen Rowley is able to express her opinion? Look, you guys are not in jail. There are no tanks rolling. You are not being sodomized. Therefore, we are not a police state. What would you tell these people?
Most people have a denial. I mean, there's something in our brains. We're hardwired to deny the harsh reality. I mean, that's the case. I mean, it's kind of a stoicism in a way that a lot of people will never admit. Even if we, you know, if you look at the Warsaw Ghetto, the poor people that were rounded up and put in the Warsaw Ghetto, they were in denial about their situation until the very bitter end. So you can find situations really, really bad, and people still want to, just for their own psychological health, they want to put the nicest spin on it. And I think that when you talk, and it depends on who your audience is, if your audience are, and you're trying to keep them still listening and not shut down, anytime you go into the harsher reality, police state, and of course there's something even worse than police state, which is, you know, Nazism or fascism. You know, you say those words and, you know, the majority of people will really shut you off. They'll say, oh, Colleen, how can you compare these two? That's unbelievable, and you're a loony if you say these things. So I think you do have to be, you have to kind of consider who your audience is and temper a bit your harsh reality. Now, it depends on who your audience is, and if you really want to tell the truth about what's going on, that's an entire different thing. There's an article on the National Law Journal, and it was written by Todd Pierce, who's one of the attorneys for the JAG attorneys for some of the detainees at Guantanamo. The title is "The Guantanamo Facility at 10: An Assault on Our Constitutional Government." And this article is really important because he's talking about the law professors here in the United States now who are going to this executive, all-powerful, war president powers that don't have to worry about Congress and the judiciary. They have to stop dissent because, you know, we're in a war. And it's a lot more than John Yoo and Robert Delahunty is the law professor here. It's a lot more than Yoo and Delahunty, who of course continue to write in this vein about war powers. It's Harvard professors. There's a Harvard and a University of Chicago law professor, and they're writing law reviews and articles about how we need to strengthen the executive branch because we're in a war and this is an emergency. And guess what? They're citing the Nazi architect, a guy named Carl Schmitt, who in the 1930s wrote a book called The Dictator. And this is where the basis for all these dictatorship powers that you invest in one executive, and you go under the premise that if we're in a war, we can't have a lot of deliberation about this. We can't get the people involved. It has to be secret and decisive, and it's got to be one individual. And all those theories go back to like the 1930s. We've got Harvard law professors citing with approval, the Nazi legal architects. That is just unbelievable. And that's, of course, not people in power. Those are actually law professors out there.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm leaning more towards this AA meeting approach for Alcoholic Anonymous, for people to stand up and say, yes, we are living under police state. And with that acceptance, then you may or we may have a chance for a change. But as long as we fudge it and try to milden it and people still see themselves as still far from being a police state, there is no urgency to get up and make changes. And then we end up basically peddling and, stay where we are today. I mean, we were in the same exact position, actually worse than we were 2 years ago. So I don't know why shouldn't we just bang, go with a bang and say, just stand up like AA meeting and start with acceptance. I, your name, live under a police state. And once that hits you as a reality and you accept that, then you start taking actions or have a chance of taking actions. Otherwise, we'll be sitting and doing the same thing next year and the year after and the year after.
Well, the good thing is, let's get to the good thing. The Occupy, most of the people in these hundreds of Occupies around the country are very aware of the police state because they've encountered. I mean, there's some cities where the police have been quite nice and permissive, but in many of the larger cities, New York and L.A. and different places, they've used weapons on the protesters. They've beat protesters. They shot the one protester in the head. So I think that there more and more, and of course some of that news did make it into the mainstream, how there was an overreaction by the police to the occupies. And the other thing is, whenever there's a national special security event, like we had here with the Republican National Convention in 2008, 41 journalists got arrested, including Amy Goodman. So when that happens, that makes news for a little while, and the average person pays a little bit of attention to it. And so I think on the good side, there are more and more people who are realizing that our civil liberties are in jeopardy. There's more people aware now of this, of the civil liberty problem, than there was, 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that will continue to grow. It's just that it's frustrating how slow it takes, for people, again, unless they're personally affected. I think that's a lot of it. Unless they're personally affected, they are watching sports on TV. They're watching all kinds of entertainment shows, reality shows, but they are not paying a whole lot of attention to what's going on, with civil liberties and that type of thing.
Colleen, recently you did an overnight road trip all the way from Minneapolis to Washington, so you could express your opposition to the continued operation of the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I thank you because in doing that, you spoke for me. And one of the people who has really struck me, because I've done a lot of coverage of Guantanamo over the last 7 or 8 years, is talking with Morris Davis. He is a colonel in the Judge Advocate General Corps who was assigned as a prosecutor at Guantanamo. And he resigned after he met with his supervisors, and they told him there could be no acquittals. And he said, at Nuremberg we had some acquittals. And he was told, oh, no, that could not happen. And this just underscores the political theater and the very cynical manipulation of the average American's belief in the Constitution and injustice, and that we stand for justice. But it's very clear that whatever military tribunals do happen at Guantanamo are rigged. The outcome is known in advance. And so I'd like to hear your comments on this as we wrap up, and we will link to the report that you filed from Washington with some very powerful photographs of you and other protesters near the White House.
Well, a lot of people from Guantanamo, a lot of the officials, the JAG prosecutors, the first commander at Guantanamo wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that Guantanamo should close. It was all a mistake, that he had been misinformed when he was the commander. I forget his name, but he was a colonel at the time it opened. So there are more and more people coming out and speaking out about it. It's true that like this Todd Pierce, who's writing this article about the law reviews and how bad that the legal theories are these days, he's a JAG. So I think that some of the best allies on the civil liberties are in the military, whereas the war hawks, people who like a John Yoo, who have these nutty ideas about empowering war presidencies, have no military experience whatsoever. And you would hope that the American public would only pay attention to the people who are more experienced and know what they're talking about, as opposed to these neocon war hawks, whatever you want to call them. I think that we went out there because I think you have to stand up. There were several hundred people who put on orange jumpsuits and walked from the White House to the Congress and then to the Supreme Court building. And it would have been great if there'd been 3, 4, 5, 10, 100 times that many.
Mm-hmm.
100, I can guarantee, if there were 100 times that many people in orange jumpsuits walking down the middle of the street, Pennsylvania Avenue, that would make a difference. And people always say, well, it won't make a difference. You know, you're marching, it won't make a difference. It is tipping points and numbers. And so we have to continue reaching out to people, not just in our choirs, not just in the, our anti-torture groups. We have to reach. That's why the photos, I thought, in this article were good, because I thought maybe there will be average, people who would see these photos and say, "What in the heck? Why are those people dressed up in orange jumpsuits?" Many people don't even know Guantanamo's still open. The majority of people see that article in a paper and their eyes go right over it because they don't want to know.
Right.
So I think we got to keep it up. And things are falling apart. I do think that this whole, if you want to call it a regime, but this whole war machine, because of lack of money, and it's the underlying, it's what is underneath all of these curtailment of civil liberties. James Madison's warning about no country can maintain its freedom in the midst of continual war. So the notion that the wars are going on and that we have to stifle dissent and all this is based on the wars. The wars, the blowback from the wars, is incredible now. And, we've got homicides of veterans returning. They're becoming, when I predicted, I'm going off on a tangent here, but when I always spoke out before the Iraq War even started, one of the things I would say is that, well, there's going to be a terrible blowback. This is going to be counterproductive. And I would use Timothy McVeigh and John Mohammed, the sniper, who were mm-hmm. both Gulf War I vets.
Yeah.
So I would use those as examples. I said, do you realize the blowback from wars? Do you realize that these two domestic terrorists, John Mohammed, the sniper, and Timothy McVeigh, were Gulf War veterans? And then people would say, oh, are you accusing you can't be accusing veterans of being terrorists. And I'd say, well, this is the problem, is it dehumanizes our troops. And the number of homicides and suicides, of course, is tremendous, and it does blow back. And people would have a hard time with this. On Department of Homeland Security and or probably terrorist policies, they are now listing veterans as a terrorist threat. That's actually listed officially.
Hmm.
That's not my opinion that it would happen based on the past. It's actually listed in documents. And so as these things fall apart and the blowback on average Americans becomes more apparent, I think then we'll start to see more pressure on the elected politicians. And, of course, our system's so bad that I don't know what's going to result. But we definitely need more pressure on the elected politicians.
Colleen Rowley, thanks for joining us again today, and thank you for being a great American and fighting for our rights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.